Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, a conversation so candid about why young Americans are leaving their faith communities that it made some in the audience rather uncomfortable. You've heard the numbers. In 2015, Pew Research found that a significant number of millennials are nuns, which means they identify with no specific faith community. St. Mary's Press, based here in Minnesota, found that disaffiliation begins as early as age 13. Last week, I went to Baltimore to moderate a discussion about why young people feel so detached from religious institutions and whether the leaders of those religious institutions care that they're losing the next generation. The audience included people of many different ages, from many different faiths and backgrounds, and a number of young people who had given up on their religious institution. The panel was diverse, too. You'll hear Janan Mohajir. She's director of student leadership at Interfaith Youth Corps in Chicago. Father Joe Muth, a Catholic priest at St. Matthew's Church in Baltimore. Beatrice Mendeville, a student with a background in the Catholic faith, but who has left her faith community. And Josh Packard, a sociologist at the University of Northern Colorado and author of the recent book Church Refugees. I started by asking some of the youngest people in the audience if they felt judged by their religious institution, and the conversation took off from there.
Oh, I have to say something?
Yes, you have to say something.
It's a conversation.
All right, but what?
Yeah, tell me. So when I said judgmental, they judge me, I saw you nodding immediately. Why?
Yeah. Just many people, friends, have church hopped, and they'll just get a bad welcome or no welcome at all. And a lot of people who have had a negative judgmental experience with a friend or a colleague or a former friend who was religious and then just kind of painted the entire religion as judgmental.
Okay. Nia, I saw you nodding as well down here in the front when I said they judge me. I don't feel opened and welcomed. Why?
I think one of the main reasons is not like the idea of God, but the people who are presenting him. Uh-huh. And that's one of the, they're like afraid of people judging them, and they just think like, what's the point of even wanting to get to know someone when all they see is a representation of them, whoever priest, you know, judging them for whatever they may come to them for.
I think I hear you saying it's the church leaders themselves, the hierarchy of the church, not necessarily that they feel like they are being judged by God or whatever higher power they believe in.
Yeah, that's the common theme that I've heard from my friends. They're like, well, the people there, they always say this to me, so I don't want to go to them for anything.
Josh, I know you've talked with grad students about this, haven't you? What do the grad students tell you about feeling like they're judged?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that, I mean, our research would resonate with and underscore all of this, that this people feel this way in church a lot, and that, you know, I think it's especially heightened now because the focus on people finding community is in a society which is increasingly disparate is so intense, and judgment from others is the single biggest anathema or stopper to community. So you've got, on the one hand, a whole group of people who are looking for community, and then you've got these religious groups where they feel like they're being judged, and so they can never fully be a part of that community.
But Janan, I think of church communities, synagogues, mosques, as having rules. People are supposed to fall in line to the rules. You're going to be judged if you don't obey the rules. What's wrong with that?
So it's interesting to think about judgment within a community as a value.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I would say what's important is how do we create a space that isn't necessarily focused on judgment, but is focused on bringing our best values to the front of the room, so as to say. And I think we struggle to do that, and that's what we're resonating. That's the resonating message that I hear from young Muslims who feel disconnected from their mosques or disconnected from their faith community, is to say, welcome me as I am, and don't expect me to fit into a box the way that you imagine it to be.
But Father Joe, aren't churches, in your case, the Catholic Church, there to say, we live by some tenets and principles, and if we're going to be a virtuous community,
we follow some of those principles and tenets. And yes, there is judgment involved in that.
Wow. That's really something.
Is it?
Yeah, well, you know, when you're trying to build a church, I'm pastor of St. Matthew and Blessed Sacrament Church here in Baltimore, and trying to build a church is about relationship building and relationship connection. And you can't build relationships with judgment. You build relationships where you suspend judgment so you get to know somebody's story and have them tell you their story.
Beatrice, why do you think it's... I mean, obviously, when we see what the Pew survey found and what we see what St. Mary's finds and other surveys about how younger Americans are feeling distanced from their faith communities because they don't feel accepted, I put that back on the leaders of the church, as Nia was saying. Why do you think this has been a message that many church leaders, synagogue leaders, mosque leaders do not get?
I just believe there's a lot of pressure on them, possibly, for them
pressure to
retain,
for what?
To retain people in the church. And so they resort to certain things that, like, intimidating certain, like, members of the church. God is going to be mad at you if you don't do this. God is going to be mad at you if you don't come to church every Sunday. I think that was a huge part for me, like, why I was so turned off by organized religion, because that happened repeatedly. My own uncle is a pastor, mm-hmm. and I lived with them for a while. And so seeing the church leaders not, like, acting, like, properly, not doing what they preach, mm-hmm. it's, like, a huge deal. And me seeing it firsthand at home was just, like, insane to me. Like, the hypocrisy, probably.
Janann, where do you think the disconnect is?
I think it's hard to create change. And it's hard when you are used to a certain practice and used to a certain interpretation of something. It's difficult to open the box and to be vulnerable and to think that there's a different story out there. As someone who's Muslim American who comes from a fairly conservative community, Muslims in the Midwest are fairly conservative, it's difficult to push the envelope on issues of sexuality, of gender, of race.
Which is something you're doing, by the way, with your work.
So outside of my day job, I'm also a founding board member of an organization called Heart Women and Girls that specifically thinks about issues of gender-based violence and also of health education for the moment for Muslim women, and our hope is to expand that to other faith communities as well.
I would think that makes a number of the Muslim leaders in town a little nervous,
work
that you're doing.
I signed off of Facebook for a few days ago because sometimes I open my account and I'm not sure who I'm going to get hate mail from, the Islamophobe or the community leader. So it's because it's difficult to push. It's difficult to push systemic things that are very common. It's difficult to push the realities that are uncomfortable for leaders.
Uh-huh.
And that change takes time, and it takes a lot of vulnerability. It takes a lot of courage on our behalf to keep pushing the conversation. And it also takes vulnerable leaders like yourself, Father Joe, who step up to the plate and say, let's have the difficult conversation and figure out how we do this.
One of the things that Beatrice got to was hypocrisy. And that is another descriptor that emerges when you talk to young Americans about what they think of their faith communities and the people that are leading them. Here's some of the specifics. They act so high and mighty, and then we see the scandals and the failings of our church leaders. Who saw the Catholic priest scandal or some other scandal in your church and thought, that's it, I'm out of here? Yes, sir?
I have a very close friend who was used to play music for his church. His family was the Front Pew family. One of their daughters had a friend who was abused, okay, and he calls that strike one. Mm-hmm. After that, they had this magnet parish where, you know, the priest was a magnificent homilist and wasn't great at organization, so he knew that he would have Sister so-and-so do the Eucharistic ministers, train the leaders to read, etc. A new bishop came in, said, you know, no women on the altar, Father does this, no one takes the finances but Father.
That was strike two?
Strike two. Third, there was an election going on, and the priest was forced to read a letter from the bishop that anyone who wore this particular button for this candidate, this friend of mine looked at his wife in the front row. She goes like this. He packed up his guitar. They took their family. They've not been to Baptist Church.
Strike three, and that was it.
So it wasn't one thing. It wasn't just one issue. It was a few things.
Josh, what do you hear in that?
That's absolutely true. I mean, all of our respondents said, you know, we would hear these long stories about, even from relatively young people, about their process of disaffiliation, and whether it's three strikes or whether it's a straw that broke the camel's back or whatever your metaphor is, it would come to a point where, you know, they would say things like, we just couldn't abide this anymore. We couldn't have this. And so it wasn't for lack of trying. They would try lots of different churches. Oftentimes they would find themselves in Catholic churches along the route, but it was a process of disaffiliation, sometimes with very identifiable stages, and it was an accumulation of events. Some of them very personal from, like, bad pastors, but a lot of them institutional, like supporting a culture of abuse.
Father Joe, I have to ask, since you are here to represent the Catholic Church, the whole Catholic Church.
All of it.
Right up to Rome and back.
The whole Catholic Church?
Actually, I said, right up to Rome and
I
back.
I might be representing the whole Christian
I'm just
Church
kidding,
because
yeah.
of the panel.
No. I am curious, though, about your perspective on this issue of hypocrisy, and specifically about what the scandals in the church have, what you hear people saying about the dissonance of that.
Yeah, there's a lot of hypocrisy in the church. That's pretty normal in a lot of ways. But I think it goes to, I think John mentioned at the beginning, and Josh talked about it too, the disaffiliation comes of a series of things that happen to somebody throughout their life before they get to the point where they say, you know, I've had it, that's it, I can't take anymore. But I think on the other side, there's just as many good, dedicated, hardworking, whatever you want to call it, kind, compassionate leaders in parishes, men and women, who are also giving another example and another kind of approach to what faith can be. And so, but if somebody hasn't had that exposure to that side either, that can be a very difficult thing if they've only seen one part of it. Hypocrisy exists. If you want to go back as far as, from my experience, not my experience, but my understanding of the Gospels of Jesus, there was a lot of hypocrisy there that Jesus took on and tried to make people change as a result of that. And that's still part of what we do. We try to take on that hypocrisy when we see it and try to make it different for another generation of people.
We being who?
We being me and my... some of the leaders of the church that I'm familiar with and that I work with on a regular basis, not only in the Catholic community, but in the ecumenical community, interfaith community, looking at a healthy way to kind of understand what this is all about. The sexual abuse scandal in the church that broke in 2002 was a horrendous, horrendous breaking of faith, of trust in people's lives, and a horrendous revelation of what was happening underneath that people didn't even know about. And the revelation of that in 2002 brought information that had been going on for like 40 or 50 years, and it all came out at once. It was a horrible, horrible experience for people to see. Faithful church people, giving up church people, all those folks, and for many people.
And the way the church reacted.
Yeah, and the way the church reacted, yeah. So
right.
Now there's the church is reacting in different ways over that in a lot of dioceses and trying to kind of get a handle on what it means to protect children and protect families and protect people when they're doing much long-awaited work to make that happen.
Janann, a thought on that?
Yeah, so we went through this recently in Chicago a couple years ago. There was a major case of sexual abuse against a prominent imam who had been abusing children and young women for over 30 years. And a group of volunteers, including myself and some other women and men, came together to sort of advocate for these survivors. And what surprises me is the sort of visceral reaction the community immediately has to kind of close off from the conversation, because there's a lot of fear that you're going to lose a lot if this opens you up for essentially target practice, right? For us as the Muslim community, the conversation that we got, or the question that we got most is, can we deal with this without the press? Can you do this without the press? Because people already are coming after us. Now you're putting a big, huge target on us. And we kind of had to say, no, this has to play out in the public sphere, because in order for these these folks who have endured this abuse and have carried this pain, in order for them to feel any sense of justice, there needs to be a public conversation. And that, we're still grappling with that in Chicago. Only five of the women and men came forward, and from the work that we did on the back end, there's many, many, many more people who are not willing to come out yet, and that's their choice, and this is a victim-centered process, and it should be that way, but it's a difficult conversation to have.
If I could just jump in a second. In the, if anybody's ever been to a 12-step program or a program with AA or NA, one of the phrases that they use is, you're only as sick as your secrets. And any of the secrets that are held by individual people or by institutions, whether it's the Muslim community, the Catholic community, when you hold secrets, that's just a horrible thing. So the openness to have the discussion is so important to help us understand if healing is possible, and if healing is possible, where do we go with what we discover, and how do we make that happen? But the secret part of that is what really breaks people down.
One of the, I heard a murmur in the audience when John said that disaffiliation begins at age 13. Who's surprised by that?
I don't think the kids are doing anything wrong. I'm looking to the parents wondering why they're not supporting the growth of their kids.
How come you're not looking at the church saying, why aren't they supporting the growth of these kids?
If the parents don't bring them to church, where is the church going to be able to support
them? I didn't hear that as these kids are at 13 deciding to make the choice to never go back to church. They're starting. I hear that as they're starting to pull away. Ellen, a microphone in front of John. John, what is that in that process of 13?
So 13 was the median age at which young people reported that they disaffiliated from the church.
They were stopping going to joining their faith communities.
It wouldn't necessarily mean that.
Okay.
So I think that's an important piece, that many of the young people that we talked to continued going to church because of family pressure. Many of the young people we talked to didn't even reveal that they considered themselves no longer Catholic or affiliated with religion or rejected religion until they were in their 20s, out of the house and so on.
But the process was beginning at 13.
The process. So that whole, the discovery was that as young as 10 years of age, so I think of an example, Beatrice, you shared in your story, 10 years of age going to church and told I have to go to confession. What kinds of sins can a 10-year-old commit?
Beatrice, since you're here, I mean, are those the kinds of things you were asking yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. I was just so ashamed. I had to sit there next to a complete stranger, the priest at the time, and just tell him all the little things, because I remember trying really hard to think of what to tell him. What did I do this week? And so it was like I said a bad word. I didn't do a chore. And then I remember just thinking about all those things and just feeling really ashamed and just awful. And this person's just sitting there telling me, yeah, that's not good, okay? As a 10-year-old, I don't think that's fair for the little tiny things. And that just creates like a trauma, I think, for a young child. And that carries on until a later age. Like, I stopped going to church probably around 20. And I would only go because of my parents, of course. After that, after I stopped going to church, I just started exploring other options. I went through a really dark time. I decided to just not feel ashamed anymore. I'm not going to go somewhere where people just look at you like you're not good enough. And I think after that, I became so liberated. It was freedom.
You said liberated.
Yes.
Let's go back to our guy who was raised in a Sicilian family and thinks it's the parents' fault. Now you've heard this. What do you think?
So if this is something that, with the new information that was just given by John about disaffiliation, if what's happening is that this is, to go back to what Father John said, Father Muth, if there's a secret, which is what it sounded like to me, this is something I'm not talking about with my parents. This is a question that I'm not asking them. Is it that there's not a conversation that's happening in the family? Is there not an opportunity for it? Do the parents not have the ability to be able to minister to their children or to answer their questions? And are we giving the parents the resources that they need?
Who has a thought on that? I'm feeling like you do.
I was raised haphazardly Catholic, I would say, going to Mass every once in a while. And now I write for a Jesuit Catholic magazine. And I think, on my more cynical days, I think I wouldn't be doing this. If I wouldn't be trying to be Catholic if it weren't for that. The 13 thing makes perfect sense to me. I remember having, like, important questions at 13, and I would ask my volunteer CCD teacher really big questions, then they're not really equipped to answer. And so I totally see a track in my life where I go towards disaffiliation. I think a lot of this is whether you care or not about whether young people are leaving. Talking about the abuse scandal, this traumatic thing, I was 9 in 2002. Like, I had no concept of what was happening then. I didn't have a chance to be mad about that until Spotlight came out. But I did have a friend who invited me into a youth group, and then someone in a youth group program asked me about my life and invited me back again. And so people just sort of pulled me along one after the other, but not everyone gets that lucky.
Is it Zach?
Yes.
Josh, I want to come back to you on something Zach said that was important, which is it depends on whether anybody really cares that you're pulling away. So what do you hear when you talk to young people about that?
There is certainly this perception that nobody cares, and that was brought up earlier this evening. That's a big part of what I think, like, if that's all that comes out of this session in the next couple of days, I mean, that would be a huge win. It's just a collective expression on behalf of the church that we are going to decide to care about this thing.
And because you don't think churches are there now?
Or? I think that, when Father Joe was saying that there are just as many good people as bad, I think he's wrong about that. There are way more good people in the church than bad.
Joe is not so sure. Just for the record.
I mean, we kept encountering people who had all these really great intentions on the one hand, and all of these young people who felt like the church was filled with people who didn't care about them on the other. It's not just an issue of communication, though. I don't want to make it sound like the church just needs to get on message.
Right.
It is also an issue of structure. So if you've heard of the last couple of things of people saying, like, you know, I had all these questions, and I had these, you know, these doubts that weren't being dealt with, and, you know, I didn't know who to go to. Well, what part of the structure of the religious experience in this country allows itself to answer and deal with questions? Precisely none of it. You know, unless you get lucky, like Zach did, and you have, as in his own words, he says, you know, I got lucky that somebody gave a crap about me at a youth group. But most people, when they think about church, they're thinking about Sunday morning, pulpit, pastor's the authority. There's no conversation happening. There's no questioning going on. And we don't live in a society anymore where that's an accepted form of authority. I don't get that in my classroom.
Janana, is that right?
I agree with that. And I've been actually thinking about a conversation that we had with our five-year-old a few months ago when a synagogue not too far from where we live in Chicago was vandalized last February. And when we were kind of discussing how we would respond to that as a family, my five-year-old sort of piped up and said, "Is that man going to break our window next?" And he followed that with a question of, is God going to protect us when that happens? So I feel like the questioning is natural. I think that happens when children are faced with the reality of what's happening in the world. The question is, does someone have our back? Does God have our back? What does that look like? And that we had to have that conversation with him at 5. So I can see that happening at 13. And what's important is to see what kind of structure is equipped to answer those questions in a meaningful way that doesn't have sort of canned answers that you get from like a pamphlet, but to actually...
God have our back.
Right. Yes. Let me look at the index, right?
When you get asked that, answer this, right?
Right.
I hear you right next to me here agreeing with a lot of what you're hearing on the panel. So what's occurring to you about this?
I'm just a very animated person, so do you know... My students count how many times I say, oh, like in class. So, yes, I am agreeing with a lot of it, but also just questioning myself. And I think questioning is a good thing. And this is what Brother Len and I, that's what our classrooms are all about, is questioning. Jesus asked a lot of questions. And you don't have to have the answers to them. I think what's going on in our world is we are finite beings, right? So we eventually die, and our life ends. But we're created by someone that's infinite. So we have this desire to know this infinite being, but we ourselves right now are not. So it's this struggle of wanting these answers from this person who's infinite. But that shouldn't be a bad thing, that we don't have these answers.
Father Joe?
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of, several people here I know who work in youth ministry in different churches. And isn't, don't you find that the age of 13 is a normal beginning of disaffiliation of kids beginning to, excuse me, teenagers beginning to ask questions and begin to back away? I mean, I have two brothers and six sisters. And when we were all growing up, at the teenage years, we all began to back away. We all began to think differently. We all began to ask some questions. And I think part of that is a normal process of growing up, from my experience. And is there in that moment, like you were saying, Zach, somebody to kind of encourage the question to go more, not just to say, well, you can't ask that. You have to say, no, tell me more. Let's go to a deeper level of what the question is bringing up to you. And I think people that in youth ministry do that all the time.
Lauren, you're 22, right, in college. So what do you hear in this question about whether the church knows what to do with young people who are asking serious questions and beginning that and listening closely and maybe beginning that disaffiliation in that moment?
Well, in my experience growing up in the Catholic Church, when I started to ask these questions and I started to become aware of my passion for LGBTQIA rights, I was asking questions and I felt a lot of resistance. And I thought to myself that, going back to hypocrisy, I remember thinking, well, wasn't Jesus the one who was asking these same kinds of questions? And going back to this kind of, well, shouldn't we be loving the people that we don't necessarily agree with? And I remember asking these questions and getting a lot of resistance saying, no, that's not how things are. And when I tried to, you know, grapple with that idea of shouldn't we be changing things like Jesus was changing things, I just felt very stagnant. And I think that stagnation is what a lot of young people are realizing in the church and realizing, like, if I want to grow and change, this may or may not be the place for me.
I'd like to come to the high school students here. These are your students who came, right?
I taught two out. Okay. But they're all wonderful.
Yeah.
But they're all wonderful.
So how old are you?
I'm 17 this year.
Okay, good.
So one of the things, actually, for a project I was doing, I studied the same Pew religious landscape data. And one of the things that I found was that almost half of Catholics disagree with what the church hierarchy says. And yet they still remain Catholic. It's just some of them choose to leave, but some of them choose to stay despite that disagreement. One of the things that's both good and bad about the church is that it's super rooted in tradition. It's super slow moving. It took the church, what, between the foundation of the United States and when Vatican II, it took it like 200 years to get used to the idea of democracy. So that slowness is good because it helps preserve that rich cultural tradition. And if people want to see change in the church, they can't just leave. They have to kind of stay and advocate for their values until they can eventually cause that same sort of change. Or at least that's how I see it.
Josh, stagnation.
Yeah.
Very slow to change.
The stagnation issue is a real one. I mean, and a part of it becomes, like, how do we see these questions? Are they a challenge to your authority? Which is, I think we are in the midst of this sort of partially generational, but epoch shift around, like, era shift around how we make sense of the information in this world that we encounter, because we encounter so much of it. So is something new that comes our way, is it a challenge to who we are as an institution? Or is it something different? And what, going back to Lauren's story, we heard this all the time in our data, that these questions were, I mean, you saw this as an example in what she's talking about. The questions, when we heard people questioning, it was really their way of experiencing God. So the challenge to the institution wasn't like, do you change and forever forget who you are, and so therefore it needs to move slowly over the course of 200 years? Or is this like, we need to change so we can keep up with our core values about who we serve and what we're here for? Part of that is about perspective.
You're listening to a discussion convened by St. Mary's Press in Baltimore last week about why so many young people are leaving their faith communities. Coming up, more about what happens when a religious institution stagnates. The unique thing about this discussion was that we had plenty of young people in the audience who were willing to speak plainly about feeling judged, spotting hypocrisy in their faith communities,
and being frustrated about how slow change comes to religious institutions. Catholic priest Father Joe Muth said he understood that at a visceral level.
Somebody mentioned stagnation, getting out of your own life. I mean, I'll say it this way. I was stagnating as a priest until I ended up in the black community. And when I was there as a pastor, I had to learn how to preach again. I learned how to, different cultural experiences, different food, different music. I had to learn a whole thing that pulled me out of myself where I was to discover another part of life that I hadn't known before. And the seminary basically taught me to preach to a white community.
Really?
I mean, they didn't teach me to preach to a black community or a Latino community or a mixed race community. So I had to rethink and regrow and figure out how do I preach now. And the black community helped me do that when I became pastor of a church here in Baltimore. But it's getting out of yourself and moving into a whole new reality of life that you've never known before and trusting that you're going to be all right in that and learning what you're going
to
learn.
I want to go back to that larger question, which I think is a really good one, which is, do these faith communities, I don't want to talk about the church, because this is happening in a lot of other, the Jewish faith and in the Muslim faith, do these faith communities care enough about what's happening, care enough to do something different, care enough to change about what's happening with disaffiliation? Janann?
Sure. So one of the things that we're seeing come about in the Muslim community is this creation of third spaces. So understanding that oftentimes, mosques, as they're structured, are not fulfilling the needs of a large portion of their community. So you have these sort of third spaces pop up that are not necessarily prayer sanctuaries, but are community centers where people who maybe don't resonate with their local mosque are able to kind of be part of a larger community, still want to identify as Muslim, still want to hold on to that part of who they are, but maybe they're not practicing in the same way. And there's a community it's in San Francisco and Chicago called Dalif Collective. That's been started by a number of different folks. And their motto, which I really love, is, you know, come as you are to Islam as it is. So it's saying, you know, come as you are. We can't promise you that it'll always be comfortable, but let's figure it out. And to me, that's a starting point. It's personally, it's not as progressive as I would like to be, but it's somewhere, it's an entry point for people to have the conversation.
How do you think the local imams feel about that?
Honestly, there's a lot of difficult conversation about how that's a threatening space, because a lot of times a lot of young people tend to prefer third spaces instead of their traditional mosques because that's where they find community.
And why is that, right?
In Chicago, it's because of the way that Chicago is. It's a segregated city. And because of that, even mosques are segregated, right? The mosques that my parents go to is primarily a South Asian Indian Pakistani mosque. The mosque that my husband grew up in, my husband comes from a biracial family. His mother is Irish-American, converted to Islam. She was Catholic before. And his father is Palestinian, and he grew up in a majority Palestinian mosque. And our kids are everything. So they don't quite fit into any of those traditional spaces. So we have found a space in the south side of Chicago where we live that is a very racially mixed, religiously mixed space, denominationally mixed space, where there's Sunnis and Shias, where there's racially mixed families and, you know, more sort of similar migrant families. So it just, that's a space where we feel like we belong, and we prefer that to our local mosque because our mosque doesn't fulfill what we need.
Do the faith leaders care enough, do you think, about what's happening with disaffiliation?
I think they have some growing up to do. Because in my, I grew up in a Hindu family, and, you know, we practice Hinduism religiously. But my daughter, you know, grew up here, and I am very open-minded. I'm probably one of the most messed up Hindus you'll find. But I believe that religion is a gym for your soul. It's different exercise, same results at the end of the day. So what I have found is we go to temple every week, and, you know, my parents and my grandparents and everybody basically is like a gathering place. You know, so when my daughter started experiencing some resistance, she was having some clashes internally. When we brought up the clashes, they were basically suppressed. So I chose to tell my daughter that, honey, you don't have to go there because I am more open-minded. Now everybody else got completely mad at me for doing that. But at the end of the day, I believe that as adults, we have more growing up to do than the kids.
Who agrees with that? The church needs to grow up. Oh, now they're talking. All right, let me come right in there.
Teens most frequently reflect the beliefs of their parents. The National Study on Youth and Religion, for example, and so I see this as operative in this space, that when we're talking about youth and young adult, emerging adult practice of faith, more often than not, we're also talking about a lack of investment in adult faith formation, especially in the Catholic tradition. And so I see that as the most operative point of view in this conversation, is the fact that adults can't articulate their own experience and practice of faith, and therefore rather be silent than talk to their kids about something they could make a mistake on or look silly.
I just want to go back up on the panel here about what do you hear when you hear people in the audience say the church needs to grow up? Beatrice, you're nodding.
I agree, just because I think they're so afraid of change altogether. And they don't realize that as a society, we are evolving and there's different things coming up. And so they need to grow within the society, the community as well, I think, to provide like the help that the community and we need as a society.
Josh, what are you hearing that?
This is absolutely true. The individuals do need to grow. And there's also a systemic, you know, issue here, too. I'm very sympathetic to what passes for leadership among a lot of our, especially Protestant churches, but also in the Catholic Church, who's pastoring the largest churches? Who's running the largest congregations in this country? And that takes some time, like any career. You don't just get placed into that job, you know, overnight. And I feel like I have this narrative running through my head where it's like, you have been placed at the top of your profession or achieved this pinnacle at precisely the time that nobody cares about that title or your authority anymore. And like how bad that must feel. Like they went to all of this school and they learned how to preach in this one particular way, and they learned authority, which is of only one kind, and that kind is that I say it and you assimilate it into your being and never question it. And then we'll do this exercise, which I stole from a kindergarten teacher in Denver, where I'll have the congregation write down three things that they wish their pastor knew about them. And it's filled with how much disagreement they have with the pastor. And I'll ask and while this is happening, I'll stand off to the side with the pastor and say, so like, how do you think this is going to happen? What do you think they're going to say? And they're so far wrong. Like, they couldn't be more wrong. Like, they're professionalized into a system that is neither good or bad. They're professionalized into a system that is now just a little bit sort of like the teeth on the wheels just don't catch anymore. For that machine to work. Like
when you say the pastor stands off to the side and anticipates what members of his congregation are going to say, and you say there's a lot of disagreement, about what?
The people will write down, like, while you're giving your sermon, I'm playing Candy Crush. Or, I don't believe in half of the things in our vision statement, or our mission statement, rather.
That is kind of core stuff. Though the Candy Crush thing is funny, I'm not listening to what you say because you don't have anything really meaningful
to
say to me on Sunday morning.
The sermon isn't the reason that I'm here.
Right.
The pastor thinks, this is more true of Protestant denominations than I think than what you'll find among Catholic parishioners, which is that the pastors often think that they are the only reason that they're, but the truth is that people are increasingly coming to these places, they're trying to find community. And you're either, so everything that you're doing is either fostering community or it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And does a sermon foster community or does it not?
You were going to say, ma'am, in the back, right there.
We're not meeting the families where they are. And then we expect them to be the ones to be able to bring their children. They don't have the answers to the questions. And so it's a really tough situation. They are the church. So how do we meet them? I've been around a very long time. My dad was divorced and remarried my mom in 1948. They were excommunicated from the Catholic Church.
Wow.
My sisters and I were all brought up Catholic. When we made our first communions, our parents came to us and said, we cannot receive the sacraments, but we are Catholic because it is our church. They taught us that the institution was one thing, but we as the church are something else.
But why does it have to be that way?
I mean, I don't think it necessarily has to be that way, but I think there's this separation has been felt. And so there becomes what's institutional and what's
the rules or what's put in place, but then it's how there's a separation from how maybe people are really living out their faith in their lives. So I wish that there wasn't that separation. I think the hope here for many people might be that they're not be that, that we could all come to see it together. But I do think I've seen that in my own life and my own studies, yeah.
Father, you want to weigh in on this?
Sure. Yeah, I think the separation you're talking about is between faith and hierarchy, that level of church, but there's also, like you were referring to, a people level of church, which is a different thing. Sometimes those two levels of church meet, and sometimes they don't meet, and trying to bridge that gap is hopefully can be done. But I think if it can't be done, the power of an organization, church of people, has to kind of take on its responsibility to kind of go back to their faith to decide who they are and let that faith guide them and lead them, you know. And it's an important thing to come together, whether it's discussion groups, small communities, small gatherings of people, to help us kind of get to the essence of what that story is, so that we can kind of live that to the best of our ability.
Josh, I have to say, you don't look very persuaded by that.
No, I think that there's this, like, there is this larger social context that's embedded here. I mean, I'm sort of like, as we talk about parents not bringing their kids to church and what the church needs to do to support that, I mean, wages in this country haven't really moved for the last 25 years, and yet the number of working hours that families engage in has gone up dramatically in order to make ends meet. So I would argue then, if you're a church that says that you care about your youth and the primary vehicle to get to the youth is through the families, and you're not politically advocating for policies that would promote wage increases, you're not actually doing that work, right? And the same thing goes for gender equity in the workplace. So as more families have become where both partners are working for pay outside of the house, we need to be, as a church, supporting the policies that would make that possible and feasible. I mean, one of the absolute facts of why people don't bring their kids to church on Sunday mornings is because they're tired, right? They're exhausted, and they would like to see their kids. In the national survey that we did following up my own qualitative research, that was like the third biggest reason people gave for what they were doing on Sunday mornings when they didn't go to church anymore. They said, I was spending time with my kids because I don't get to see them that much during the week.
But that also tells me that there's nothing happening that's so compelling at that church that outweighs, yeah. I saw Lauren giving you a right on here, so.
Thank you, yeah. So what I was noticing is that question of do they care enough to change really brings it in for me is I hear a lot of people, you know, I hear a lot of comments around the church saying, we need more priests. And I'm like, let's open it up to the other half of the population then. And I think that's the same with a lot of this, as I'm saying, I don't think that women can solve all the problems in the church, but I think not having women in the hierarchy is a problem in itself because we're ignoring the merit of half of the body of Christ and not inviting them into the other half of the church that is the institution.
Janann, happening in your faith as well.
Systemic patriarchy is a problem. My husband often jokes.
Newsflash.
Yeah, surprise. My husband often jokes and says all of the world's problems should be blamed on patriarchy in our house, which is true. It should be.
I could go along with that.
But those are very deep-rooted systemic issues to overcome. And I think oftentimes we push against those issues with the same tools over and over again. And I think, I can't remember who said this, but insanity is basically doing the same thing over and over again with no different result, right? So what we have to do is also think outside of the box and think about how do we approach some of these systemic issues with different strategies. What does that look like? What does it mean to bring a different view to how we push back against the systemic problem and actually start to educate, start to look at what conversations are already happening and how can we kind of take those conversations and tweak them to fit the issues that we need to talk about the most.
So I think in the time we have left, the next couple of minutes, it would be interesting to talk about what's the fix. So if my church community was more fill in the blank, I'd be more interested. Can you answer that, sir, up there? Great. Thanks.
How you doing? My name is
Hi.
James. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
The fix is full inclusion, diversification, along with preparing our young people to face the negativity that the world throws at organized religions.
Let me go to some other people here on, thank you, on the fix. Father Joe, a reflection on that?
Yeah, well, I think where we have to be open to the different aspects of what people are really dealing with in their life. So when we opened our doors to gay and lesbian people and we began to have an outreach to gay and lesbian people, it was an important part of people's lives because gay people are actually, they're just gay. They're not, you know, monsters. They're not horrible. They're just gay people. And you have to find a way to, they're Catholic too.
I think you're preaching to the choir here.
And they're asking.
People that.
But they ask the question because of what they've heard, can I be gay and Catholic, you know?
Right.
And I ask them, are you gay? They say yes. I said, are you Catholic? I say yes. I say, well, you're gay and Catholic. But they want to become a part of a community. So a community has to open its doors to say, you're welcome here and you can be a part of us. So we have to meet people where they are to really help the church to become alive and be the future church that we hope it can be.
All right. Jesus, right?
Yes. I was very close to also disengaging when I was in high school. Very close. And I went through a whole period of questioning. My dad, instead of worrying or going crazy of, oh my gosh, I'm losing my kid, you know, he simply was there to listen. And he did not judge. He didn't have the answers. He just walked with me and listened. And I think that I believe during high school years, it is normal for our young people to disengage, not only with the church, but in many other institutions, school, or many other things. They begin to question so many things. It is how we accompany them during that process. How can we be catechetical companions during this, pastoral companions during this process, and listen?
Right down there.
Hi. I wanted to say something maybe radical about this, controversial. I think if I had a magic wand and I could say tomorrow in all our churches and all religions, shazam, there would be full inclusion of anybody who wants to be included in all kinds of hierarchies, any kind of abuse, gone. That's just done. That's not happening. I don't think that disaffiliation would stop. I don't think it would slow. And I know that because I've done research on non-religious organizations, and when I go to visit the Humanist Society and I walk in and, you know, I'm walking through the shadow of the Valley of 50 and I'm the youngest person in the room, and they're excited because young people are coming or my undergraduate students are coming. It's the same kind of thing. There are other factors involved here that are not about hierarchy. They're not about belief. They're not about controversy. They're about how people gather, about how they attach to what gives them feeling of awe and wonder. So at the same moment that Pew is tracking a decline in other organizations in affiliation, they're tracking increases in people experiencing moments of awe and wonder. And so much our conversations about religion are about what do people believe and what's the hierarchy do. And I don't know that the fix on any of those kinds of things is going to be changing those things. And I don't know that the fix long term is going to look anything like religion looks now, or that we can even imagine it. We can be part of what it becomes next, or we can be hanging around to sweep the floors and turn out the lights.
You've been listening to a conversation about disaffiliation among young Americans. It was convened in Baltimore, Maryland by St. Mary's Press. And our panel included Janann Mohajir, she's Director of Student Leadership at Interfaith Youth Corps, Father Joe Muth, a Catholic priest at St. Matthew's Church in Baltimore, Beatrice Mendeville, a student with a background in the Catholic faith but who has left the church, and Josh Packard, a sociologist at the University of Northern Colorado and author of the recent book Church Refugees. If you missed part of the conversation, you can find it on my podcast. You can also find it online. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you get your podcasts.